But in the series, in the study that we've been going through, we've been following the early peoples of the world as they obeyed and as they sometimes did not obey God's command for them to be fruitful, to multiply, and to scatter themselves across the face of the whole earth and to replenish it. And we finished last time in Genesis 19. You don't have to go there yet. We'll be coming back to that. We finished last time in Genesis 19, and I'm sure you're very familiar with the story of Lot and his daughters. And we left them in a cave up in a mountain behind the what he called the little city of Zoar. Now God's word pretty well finishes with Lot. At that point, God gave us lots of examples and lessons, and most of them were bad ones, but then he leaves them there in that cave and he moves on. Now, I believe that Lot was something of a favorite of the Lord because, not really that he was, because he made lots of mistakes, if you'll excuse the pun, he made lots of mistakes, but I believe that he blessed Lot almost as a side product of his blessings on Abraham. Lot is only mentioned after Sodom and Gomorrah. He's only mentioned after this in another three scriptures, and they mention the lands that Lot's descendants inherited. Let's just read them as a matter of interest. Deuteronomy chapter 2, please. Deuteronomy chapter 2. Sorry, we're trying out this new speaker system and it might make some funny noises every so often, and please excuse us if it does. We'll try and get something better for next time. Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 9. And the Lord said unto me, distress not the Moabites, neither contend with them in battle, for I will not give you of their land for a possession, because I have given Ar unto the children of Lot for a possession. And then jump down please to verse 19. Verse 19. And when you come nigh over against the children of Ammon, distress them not, nor meddle with them. For I will not give you of the land of the children of Ammon any possession, because I have given it unto the children of Lot for a possession. Now, again, it's certainly not for me to criticize the decisions of our great Creator, but I can't help feeling, after all that we read last time, that in some respects, Lot received more real estate than he really deserved. Again, we ask the question, was the Lord really pleased with Lot and his children and his later descendants? Well, from the third of these three post-Zoar mentions of Lot, we're going to go over, please, to Psalm 83. I would think not. I would think that the Lord was not pleased with the descendants of Lot. Because here in Psalm 83, we find that Lot's descendants are associating themselves with the Lord's enemies. The Lord's enemies, people who hated the Lord, hated his ways, and hated his people. Psalm 83 and verse 1. Psalm 83 and verse 1. Keep not you silence, O God. Hold not your peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, your enemies make a tumult, and they that hate you have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted against your hidden ones. And I think the word is better, the word for hidden is better better translated treasured. Consulted against your treasured ones and have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederates against you, against the Lord. And the psalmist, we believe it was a man by the name of Asaph, then lists 9 of these enemy states. Won't go through all of that, but jump down to verse 8. In verse 8, Asher also is joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. Selah, he says, Selah. And we believe that what the psalmist is saying there is, hey, that's significant. Notice that. So we say farewell to Lot and his daughters now, and let's go back to Abraham. Relatively obedient Abraham, certainly compared with Lot. And let's go back to Sarah and the whole group there, and they were still on the move. They were still on the move, and they were going southward. Let's go all the way back to Genesis now, Genesis 20. Genesis chapter 20 and verse 1. Genesis 20 verse 1. And Abraham journeyed from thence. And where it says thence, we believe that he was probably in Mamre at that time, in Mamre of by Hebron, toward the south country. So he's going south now, and dwelt, and there's that word Yashab again, and dwelled between Kadesh and Shur, and sojourned in Gerar. It says sojourned, the word is Gur, talk about that in a minute, G-U-W-R, in Gerar. Okay, let's get our bearings here. Kadesh, and if you want to consult, if you've got maps in the back of your Bible, that's fine too. Kadesh means holy, and it was a city in the extreme south of the area that would later become the tribal territory of Judah. And it's elsewhere referred to as Kadesh, K-E-D-E-S-H, or Kadesh Barnea. There's a place there called Shur in verse 1. Shur means wall, W-A-L-L. And it was in the southwest part of Judah, on the east border of Egypt, or possibly even within the border of Egypt at that time. The Israelites at a later time under Moses passed through the wilderness of Shur right after they crossed the Red Sea. I'll just give you the, you don't have to turn there now, Exodus chapter 15 and verse 22. And it's the wilderness of Shur is elsewhere referred to as the wilderness of Etham, E-T-H-A-M. Okay, and the third place there is Gerar, G-E-R-A-R. And it means lodging place, and that's possibly very significant in the case of Abraham. We're talking about this was a Philistine town south of Gaza, and it's currently believed by archaeologists to be located in modern times in the modern valley of a place called Nahal Gerar, and it's in the Negev desert. Not the nicest place to be. Okay, so let me repeat then. Abraham and his group dwelt, they yashabed in between Kadesh and Shur, and they sojourned in Gerar. And again, the Hebrew word for sojourn is Gur, G-U-W-R, and possibly there's a possibility that the place name of Gerar was related to the verb Gur, the sojourn possibility. Now, you might remember from last time, those of you who were with us last time, we examined the difference between the two words Yashab and Gur. And what we found that long-term dwelling, and this is not necessarily for us, this is for the early peoples, including Abraham and his group, long-term dwelling or yashabing appears to have been a no-no to the Lord Whereas temporary sojourning or guring, if you will, G-U-R, G-U-W-R, appears to have been acceptable to the Lord. But we also find, we found it last time, we find it again here, that there's two meanings to the word gur. And if the group, if Abraham's group overstayed their limits, the limits of the first and positive meaning of the word gur, in other words, a short-term sojourn and the seeking of temporary hospitality, then if they overstayed those limits and if they were there for too long, then the alternate, the negative meaning of the word gur might kick in. And that is to stir up trouble, strife, quarrels, and negative excitement. And that is exactly what happened again in the case of Abraham and Sarah and their group. Exactly the same, exactly as what happened to them with the Egyptian Pharaoh back in chapter 12. And for exactly the same reasons. First of all, possibly because of the length of their halt. And secondly, because of exactly the same fib that Abraham and Sarah told the ruler about the identity of Sarah. He called her Sarah the Beautiful, and she must have been some looker. She must have been something else, for even for her age. Let's move on to verse 2. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now again, Gerar was in Philistia. And from what we know, Abimelech was apparently the king of all Philistia. So again, what happened here, another set of problems resulted. And once again, possibly for this extended halt that was unacceptable to the Lord. And again, also definitely for Abraham telling this pseudo-fib to the king. Anyway, after all of that mess got sorted out, and we're not concentrating on all of these fine details, what we're looking at here is the aspect of them on the move, that God wanted them to be on the move. So were they on the move or were they stopped? And that's important to our study. Anyway, after that mess got sorted out with Abimelech, and really, if you think about it, with surprising benevolence under the circumstances, but with the king, with Abimelech, knowing without a doubt that the Lord favoured this special couple, because the Lord came to him in a dream and warned him. Said, you know, she's not for you, you know. Okay. But what after the row got sorted out, very significantly, Abimelech offered Abraham and Sarah a free choice of another stopping place within his kingdom. Verse 15. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell, Yashab, where it pleases you." Now, when we read through this, and we read it verse after verse, on first reading we might think that this halt here at Gerar, it all took place within a very short time span. But the following verses, 17 and 18, imply otherwise. Let's read them. Verse 17. So Abraham prayed unto God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maidservants, and they bore children. For the Lord had fast closed up all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. So this was a temporary barrenness that the Lord had imposed on these women of the land of, around Gerar there. This temporary barrenness of these Gerarite women, if we think that it only lasted for a couple of days, it had hardly even been worth a mention here in the scriptures. But we know that some, if you look at it logically, some time, a couple of months at the very least, would be required for the Gerarite women to even find out that their wombs had been closed up. But this timing is of primary importance to our study, because it gives an idea of how long Abraham and his group, Yashabd, dwelt in Gerar. But, as it turned out, this halt, this actually might have been a good time for a halt, because Sarah at last, at long last, became pregnant with Isaac. And we go into the detail of that in the very next verse in Genesis chapter 21. Genesis chapter 21 and verse 1. Genesis chapter 21 and verse 1. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. Verse 3. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Now, a question here now. But where had Abraham chosen to dwell during Sarah's pregnancy? Where? What was the location? We find out in verse 31. Verse 31. Wherefore he called that place Beersheba. Abraham called that place Beersheba because there they swore, both of them, talking about Abraham and Abimelech. And verse 32, they made a covenant at Beersheba. We'll talk about that covenant, that swearing, in a minute. The literal meaning of Beersheba, there's actually two ideas of what it means. One is the well of the sevenfold oath. Well of the sevenfold oath. I'm just trying to remember what the other one is. The other one is just seven wells, the place of seven wells. The word beer, splitting it up into the two words, beer comes Strong's 875. It means well, pit, or spring. And Sheba, Strong's 7651, means seven or seventh. Second half of verse 32. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned from Beersheba into the land of the Philistines. Now, I find this a little bit confusing, the last part, the last phrase there of verse 32, a little bit confusing, and it may not be really important to our study, but Beersheba, we believe, was actually in Philistia at that time. And this verse says that they, again probably Abimelech and Phicol, returned into the land of the Philistines. And so I wondered about that, and the only thing I could think is a big possibility, a great big maybe here, that once Abimelech gave Beersheba to Abraham, that he no longer considered it to be part of Philistia. That's the only way I can think about the way that turns out. What is more significant, though, is the reason for this sworn covenant between Abraham and Abimelech. And the reason for this covenant was the patching up of yet another row between them, between Abraham and Abimelech. And that row had blown up over a theft, actually. A theft by some of Abimelech's men, and this was unauthorized by Abimelech himself, but the theft of a very valuable well that Abraham's men had dug. And that's where that the idea of Sheba, of Beer rather, the well, the pit or the spring comes into the name of Beersheba. And it was all because of this well. And we turn the tap on these days and we don't even think about where we get our water from. Wells in those places, even now in this day and age, are very valuable, virtually priceless. And I don't know how somebody could steal a well, but still, I guess they moved in on it and said we're gonna take this area around. Sorry about that. Okay. So that was the cause of the row that caused the covenant to take place. Let's continue then. What happened next after this row was patched up? Verse 33. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba. And Abraham planted a grove in Beersheba. Why does this remind me of Genesis chapter 9 and verse 20, where we read just a couple of weeks ago about Noah planting a vineyard after he left Ararat? Why does it remind me of that? Continuing in verse 33, and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham stayed in the land of the Philistines many days. Could be a problem. Could have been a problem in two ways. First of all, because Abraham and his party stayed there many, many days. And secondly, because he planted something called a grove. And it's the first mention, as far as I know, in the scriptures, of the word grove. Now, I like to pray outside. I like to go and walk down by the ocean, or go and walk in and wooded areas, like where there's a forest, are lovely, quiet places to pray. Wonderful places to call on the name of the Lord, as Abraham did here. But groves throughout the scriptures, throughout the Old Testament, are generally condemned by God in many, many Old Testament scriptures. But there are actually two Hebrew words that are translated grove in the scriptures. The best known type is the sinful kind of grove. The word appears 40 times in the Old Testament, and it's translated from the Hebrew word Asherah, A-S-H-E-R-A-H, Strong's 833. And that word Asherah may be familiar to many of our brethren. And these were groves of trees, or groves of poles, like wood henges type of things, that were set up near heathen altars and used in idolatrous worship, and specifically worship of a heathen goddess of the same name, Asherah. Asherah had different names depending on the nationality of the worshippers, and some of those names you might be familiar with as well: Astarte, Ashtoreth, Ostara, Eostra, or Easter. And she was the supposed partner of Baal. And she was variously thought of as a goddess of fertility, of motherhood, of fortune, or happiness. Okay, that is the heathen type of grove. The other kind, and the type that Abraham grew, comes from the word Eshel, E-S-H-E-L, Strong's 815. And it simply means tamarisk, and it represents one or more tamarisks. Read up a little bit about what is a tamarisk. I've heard that it's a tree. There's actually 50 or 60 species of tamarisk. They're sometimes called salt cedars in some places, and they're native to Eurasia and Africa, tamarisks. I'm going to read you a little clip from John Gill's commentary. John Gill And he says, Jewish writers are divided about the use of this grove, specifically this one of Abraham. And he quotes a Jewish writer by the name of Yarki. He says, Yarki relates that one opinion says it was for a paradise or orchard to produce fruits out of it for travelers and for entertainment. Another source says that it was for an inn to entertain strangers in. But he disagrees with them. This Yarki guy says that it rather was for a shade to shelter from the sun in those sultry and hot countries. And perhaps, he says, for a religious use and to be an oratory. That's a place of speaking. This is an oratory today. As the following words seem to suggest, and the following words are, and Abraham called there on the name of the Lord. It's going back to John Gill now. In the midst of it, in the midst of Abraham's grove, he says, very likely, I'm not sure about that, he says, Abraham built an altar and sacrificed to the Lord. There's really no true evidence. He said, likely, there's no evidence of that. Hence might come the superstitious use of groves among the heathen, and when they came to be abused for idolatrous purposes, they were forbidden by the law of Moses. And then he says, what sort of trees this grove consisted of cannot with certainty be said. Very probably the oak. And again, he's got no backup for that either. And he quotes another Jewish writer, scholar, by the name of R. Jonah. And he says, R. Jonah thinks it may be the tree which in Arabic they call Ethel, which is a tree like that which is called tamarisk. But in general, it signifies any tree, and especially large trees. Okay, so the thing is, how long would it have taken Abraham to grow a grove? We think back to Noah, and how long would it have taken Noah to grow proper fruit-bearing vine trees in his vineyard? We ask the same thing here. But other than the length of time that it would have taken to grow the trees of a grove, the fact that this scripture is the only one using this word eshel indicates that there was nothing inherently wrong with Abraham planting it. Anyway, what next? Let's move along. What next for Abraham? We ask the question, had he come to the end of his journeyings? Did he stop in Beersheba? Or did God have any more travelling in store for him? Well, yes, he did. Yes, he did. And the next journey was a very, very special journey that God sent him off on. And, lots of reasons for it, but perhaps one of the smaller reasons was perhaps because he and Sarah needed another shot in the arm that they would get by another test of their faith. And this was the big one. This was perhaps the biggest one that any human being could be faced with. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham? And he said, Behold, here I am. Now, just that one verse, we ask the question, did God's word contradict itself here? Because, and you don't have to turn there, I'll just quote it, James chapter 1 and verse 13, where God said through the apostle James, Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man. But there's really no contradiction, because there was certainly nothing being, they weren't being tempted with evil. And the word tempt in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 1 there is translated from the Hebrew verb nakah, N-A-C-A-H, Strong's 5254. And it might be better rendered to try, to prove or to assay, or assay, in the same way as the assaying of gold, silver, and other precious metals. And although the Hebrew verb is different, we see the same spiritual analogy of the proving and purifying of precious metals in Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 3. Again, for the sake of time, I'll just read it for you. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 3. The refining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, but the Lord tries the hearts. Tries the hearts. Okay. Didn't the Lord ever try the heart of Abraham in this case? Yes, and Isaac too, and obviously Sarah too, with this journey and with this huge, huge test. Back in Genesis chapter 22, continuing in verse 2, where we see yet another command for Abraham to hit the road. Verse 2. And he said, the Lord said, Yahweh said, take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and look, and get you into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell you of. Now, again, you don't have to turn there, but according to 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1, Mount Moriah was the same hill in Jerusalem where Solomon built the first of God's stone temples. It's interesting that the Samaritans who live there, and they only recognize the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, they make a controversial claim that Mount Gerizim is the original location of Mount Moriah. But, okay. Staying with the idea that it was at Jerusalem. Verse 3. And Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son and clave the wood, chopped the wood for the burnt offering and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. So they traveled for 3 days from Beersheba, and this place of Mount Moriah where they were going to was still afar off. So possibly going to take them another day to get there. Possibly. And we'll talk about that next time. But the point-to-point distance between Beersheba and Jerusalem, assuming that that's where it was, is about 70 kilometers and about 42 miles for you Americans. But even today, the road distance is considerably more. It's one of those you can't get there from here, you know. And the actual road distance is more than 100 kilometers, about 60 miles. Let's continue on, still concentrating again on the travel related verses and statements here. Verse 5. And Abraham said unto his young men, abide you here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. Verse 8. And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went, both of them, together. Verse 9. And they came to the place which God had told him of, and Abraham built an altar there. Verse 14. And Abraham called the name of that place Yahweh Yireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. Verse 19. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. So this was a round trip hike of about 200 kilometers, about 120 miles. But why? Have you ever asked yourself why? Why did the Lord send Abraham and Isaac all that way from Beersheba to Mount Moriah to do the sacrifice. Why did not the Lord just have Abraham perform the sacrifice right there in Beersheba, right in Abraham's backyard behind his tent? Why? Why did they have to go to this place? I want to leave you with that question. I want you to think about these questions, and we're going to come back next time and answer them in part 5.